WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center. And always on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Richard Cantu. From Washington, D.C., word that what's described as a small aircraft is down in the Potomac River near Reagan National Airport. Fireboats on the scene. There's a ground stop in effect at Reagan National. The cost of money to stay the same. Jerome Powell, chair of the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee, after Wednesday's meeting.
Inflation has moved much closer to our 2% longer-run goal, though it remains somewhat elevated. In support of our goals, today the Federal Open Market Committee decided to leave our policy interest rate unchanged and to continue to reduce our securities holdings.
He added, it appears the U.S. economy expanded a solid 2% last year. A federal judge here in New York City sentenced disgraced former New Jersey Senator Robert Menendez to 11 years in the penitentiary on his corruption-related conviction. Two individuals who paid bribes to Menendez got 7 and 8 years. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
The Bucks lose again in Portland. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks lost to the Trail Blazers, 125-117. Giannis Antetokounmpo asked, how has Portland beat them 3 out of 4 tries since they traded Damian Lillard away to Milwaukee?
Good team, play fast, have a lot of people that can make shots over the dribble. You know, when you give a team confidence, they beat you.
The Bucks road trip continues when they face the Spurs in San Antonio tomorrow night. College basketball, number 9th ranked Marquette, with a win in Indianapolis, beating Butler 78-69. Cam Jones got into foul trouble, so Stevie Mitchell stepped up, scoring a career-high 22 points. Number 17th ranked Wisconsin and Maryland tonight, head coach Greg Gard, on why he thinks the Badgers have improved on offense.
You know, an unselfish group that doesn't care who gets the credit, and it's a really talented team that have a lot of weapons that can shoot it, and pretty much everybody we put on the floor is a legit threat from three.
That's Wisconsin head coach Greg Gard. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Matt Nair on air.
Dan Schaefer, Civic Media's political editor.
No court in the country came closer to overturning the 2020 election results than the conservative majority on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And we have Brad Schimmel, who's been siding with January 6 rioters. So if you want your vote to count going forward, show up and vote on April 1st. Let's channel that energy into the Wisconsin Supreme Court race.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Want to share some good news. Oh, I've had a lot of people over the last couple of months reach out, wish me, my family, especially my wife, the best. Thoughts and prayers, good positive energy, good juju, all of that stuff. As many of you may know, my wife was involved in a motorcycle accident back in September. A careless driver made a left-hand turn in front of her without warning, without any chance to avoid it, ran into my wife while she was riding her motorcycle. And since September 12th, we have been basically living in a hospital setting. And, you know, thank goodness for our ability to be able to be with her. We have been with her every minute of this entire period, my daughter and I and the family, that she's never been alone. And with a traumatic brain injury, one of the things that you want to make sure is when they wake up, when they open their eyes, they see people that they remember, may remember, people that mean something to them, people they love, and to help with the recovery. So we've been doing that. And in that process, I've learned a lot about the healthcare industry. I've talked a lot about it over the years and some of the really horrible negative stuff that has been conveyed to me over the years. But, oh, when you have to go through it, it's something. And we've got a broken healthcare system. Look, they are doing wonderful work caring for my wife, the doctors, the nurses, the people who are doing the work are fabulous, great people who are doing the best they can in a broken system. That, you know, I don't know how nurses do it. I don't know how people do it, being put thrust into a situation where every day you're set up to fail, where you're overworked and the expectations are impossible to meet. And I understand that. And I get a little frustrated too. So I'm not always the best person to deal with. I can be a little grisly. I can be a little abrasive. But I also understand, and I really try to be someone who understands their position as well, being in the position that I'm in. But the system's broken. It's crazy broken. And the reason I wanted to share today is things are going as planned. There is some hope that she will recover to some functionality. She's never going to be the person she was that morning of September 12th. But she may lead a functional life, and for that, we're grateful. But the reason I wanted to bring it up today is I got a bill from my insurer, and thank goodness to my Teamsters Health and Welfare Fund. Thank you for everything you've done for us and the help you've given us in fighting to advocate for my wife and her needs. But I got a bill from the rehab hospital where she spent 65 days, the first stint. We're back at the rehab hospital now. But the bill was $627,091.62 for 65 days. It's like $9,600 a day. Now, that's not the $540,000 for 22 days from the last place. And what's interesting to me is what the insurance company actually pays of this number. Of the first day, the $540,000, they paid $92,000. And that's what the place accepted. It's this giant accounting scheme, this voodoo kind of economic. Nobody can explain why or how or what. We all have our assumptions. We all have ideas. But it shows, again, how broken our system is because the insurers seem to have more power than the doctors. But I wanted to take a moment to share that just outrageous, because we're right around $2 million in healthcare costs, of billed healthcare costs. And I'm fortunate because I do have good health insurance. I can't imagine what life would be if, one, or I didn't have it, or two, I had one of these plans that, well, doesn't cover much. And these are conversations. The reason I bring this up is, one, I want to thank everyone who's reached out and thought about my wife and thought about my family. Thank you. But also, I want to be grateful for what I have. And I want other people to be able, in these tragic moments, to have the same kind of peace of mind, the same kind of hope that I've been fortunate to have. And I know this is not what normally we go through. Normally it's like, how do you get that? You shouldn't have it. I want everyone to do well. I want everyone to have the kind of peace of mind that comes with knowing, look, I've got decent health insurance. If I get sick, I'm going to be cared for. If something bad happens, we're going to be okay. And fortunately, my family in this moment is going to be okay. Unfortunately, I've had so many people reach out and share their tragedies and share their heartbreak and share their struggles with these insurers and with these giant healthcare corporations. I hear you. I understand. And I'm just as angry. We got a lot of work to do. But I just wanted to throw it out there. I wanted to say thank you. Because in this moment, it really, really does mean a lot. We got a lot to get to. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1834. That was the first time in United States history that a president called in federal troops to settle a labor dispute, and it certainly would not be the last. President Andrew Jackson ordered federal troops to quiet the workers on the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal. The workers were predominantly Irish, but also included Germans, Dutch, and African Americans. They were digging a canal along the route of the Potomac River, which had rapids that made it difficult to traverse. The primary purpose of the canal was to bring coal from the Allegheny Mountains to eastern port cities. The goal was to connect the ports to the Ohio River and Ohio Valley. Work on the project was grueling. Rocky ground made digging the canal extremely difficult. Workers labored 12 and even 15 hours a day. They often had to work in ditches with mud or water up to their waists. They lived in poor conditions in shanty towns along the canal route. In 1932, cholera swept through the work camps, leaving death in its wake. Work stoppages plagued the project, which had originally been conceived by George Washington. 10 different significant incidents of labor unrest occurred during the more than two decades the project was underway. Workers became fed up with hard labor, low wages, and dangerous conditions. Andrew Jackson sent in troops to stop the workers' rebellion. The C&O Canal never made it to the Ohio Valley. The coming of the railroad derailed the completion of the project 180 miles from its planned ending point. All was not lost, however, as the president's action to send in troops to suppress workers set a precedent that others would follow in the years ahead. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we just lived through a presidential temper tantrum. A country, Colombia, said, no, we're not going to let you land and drop those folks from your planes here in our country. Trump had his little temper tantrum. No, we're going to put tariffs on you, 25, 50, gazillion. And, well, Colombia then gave, eventually. And I think we're going to see a lot more of this. I think we will see a lot more bullying tactics. It's Trump. It's who he is. And I do think you're going to see a lot more people caving. We'll see. But here to share some thoughts on the presidential temper tantrum. And if this is what we're going to see, I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come share some thoughts. Scott's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Great to be with you.
So, what are your thoughts on this this presidential temper tantrum?
Well, I would say everybody who had a hot take had to like reverse it within like 3 hours. Yeah. Because the situation changed rapidly, as you pointed out. Yeah, I will say, like, in principle, I am not opposed to the idea of using tariffs to gain leverage for public policy reasons. Okay. I think that's perfectly reasonable, whether it's for labor rights, which is something that I think a lot of us support, could be other things as well. So I'm not opposed to the idea of doing that. What I think is a little more concerning, and I'm going to set aside the politics of immigration here, because I know some people will like that, some people won't like it, but just it is where this kind of like presented itself in the sequence of tactics. And this is what concerned me, is like, this was the go-to, right? This is like what he did right away. It wasn't like, let's escalate up to this to see if we can resolve this in another way. But it was immediately this, let's get the papers ready to do the 25%. And Colombia, which has a lot of trade exposure, a lot of exposure to the US market, you know, they import or they export a lot of petroleum products, cut flowers, coffee, as everybody knows, in the United States. So they were like, okay, this is not good. So I think that it can be done in a more strategic way. I'm just saying that really politely. And I don't know that it needs to be the go-to, like right away, yeah. You're gonna do this all the time. Because I think after a while, it probably loses its luster. Don't you think? You know, no, that's like what you're going to do. Yeah.
No, that's where my mind is. And look, I think we need to use our power when necessary. I just don't know on Columbia. And I don't know, you know, on this. This is one of those things where you go, if you need to, need to put a little muscle down, you do that when you need to. Yeah. But Columbia? I mean, or was this, you know, I'm sending a message to everybody else. If you don't do what I say, this is what's going to happen to you. And maybe he doesn't do it again, but I got to tell you, I think he got his way. He threw his temper tantrum. I think we're going to see a lot of this.
Well, I think you're right. And so really, in the case of Colombia, an asymmetrical negotiation, right? He has all the power, all the leverage. They have none. So, Rick, I think you may have hit something that it sends a signal out that, look, when I say we're going to do something, we're going to do something. If you're going to stand in the way of that, there's going to be a consequence, and it could be an economically damaging consequence potentially. Yeah. So, you know, it's funny because I was like, I didn't have 25% tariffs on Colombia as the first action on my trade bingo card. And it turned out that didn't even happen. Right. So,
so if it didn't actually happen, did it actually happen?
Yeah, I don't think it did. I think I have to take that one back. That was like a spoiled ballot or bingo card or something like that.
Oh, so now you've got them worked up. Now you got people worked up about spoiled ballots. Here we go. I can see the emails now. But the reason I wanted to have you come on and talk about, you know, Trump and trade is he put out a memo, not an executive order, but a memo saying that there are certain things we should be looking at. And a lot of the stuff on there I don't disagree with. You know, like, you know, getting rid of permanent normal trade relations with China, I think is not a bad idea. Closing the de minimis loophole that we've talked about so many times. I think those are things worth looking at.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's interesting because people who kind of parachute in and form the punditry, which is unfortunately woefully uninformed in a lot of ways, like, why didn't he do tariffs on the first day? He said he was going to do tariffs. I'm actually quite glad that he didn't, that it's a little more deliberate because it will show there's a little more strategy behind it. And so, yeah, this memo, I mean, is a serious, like, trade nerd's, like, dream here when you get into it, because it does really look at every aspect of trade policy. And I'm just going to say, like, if all of these, like, things that are started in motion end up somewhere, from my perspective, that's going to be a good thing.
Yeah.
Like, I want that to be successful because you just pointed out some of the issues. It's like, did China live up to its original phase one trade agreement that Trump negotiated with them? No. And what should the consequences be? Should China have permanent normal trade relations? No. How do we unwind that? What should a renegotiated U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement look like? Because there are a lot of loopholes there that are problematic. Is China still violating intellectual property rights? You know, yeah. What should we do about our trade deficits? Are countries doing currency manipulation? Is this de minimis loophole, you know, resulting in a lot of fentanyl coming in or precursors coming to the United States? And the answer is yes to that. And so I think all of it is good to kind of like compile the evidence here and to make the case for action. And so I do hope that it is action and not just rhetoric, because I'm just going to say, having watched the first round of this administration from 2017 to 2021, there were a lot of things that got started. Like, there was a let's make our energy pipelines in America executive order that was signed in the first week, and that is literally the last we heard of it. It never amounted to anything, never did anything like that. He started to talk about Buy America, Hire America. I think that part of it was he probably lost focus. I think part of it is there was a bureaucracy standing in the way that was very much dominated by, like, Heritage Foundation types. That never really materialized until he did something the last couple of days before he left office to set a couple things in motion. So I do want it to be more consequential than that and to be strategic. But what was in that memo itself, I would say, from an industrial policy or an industrial union point of view, There was certainly nothing objectionable.
Right.
Okay. And there were actually a lot of very good things in it, if they happen. And that, to me, sets it apart, obviously, from a lot of other things that, that he was doing or up to. But interestingly, Rick, and I'll conclude my thought on this point, is like, yeah, I don't know if you'll agree with this or not, but one of the more strategic policies he had in his first term was the trade stuff, right? You know, that you got some tariffs on steel and aluminum, and they helped a little bit. You got a renegotiated NAFTA that wasn't perfect, but it was better than it was, and it showed a little bit more strategy than the other stuff. And I think part of it is because of the people he had doing it.
You know, Bob Lighthizer. Now, I was just going to ask you about this because, look, he didn't write this memo. He wasn't up at 3 o'clock in the morning with the Diet Coke, you know, on the Golden Throne, you know, writing this stuff out. It's the people who are around him and the folks who are going, hey, we need to put together a strategy. And what the reason I brought this up and though I wanted to talk to you about this is because, look, there are some things that we can possibly get that will be pretty good for working people if we can get in that direction, this stuff being part of it. I don't want, you know, folks to hear this and go, oh, Trump did it and we've got to dismiss it immediately. This is one of those areas where you go, we might be able to work something here that's better. Because look, we've been talking about trade enforcement, we've been talking about trade with China, we've been talking about, you know, massive deficits for decades now. The fact that it is something that he's thrown out there, even if he doesn't have a plan, I think is important. The fact that it is now front and center, and maybe this will give Democrats a point where they go, yeah, these are issues that are important to working people. Maybe we'll come up with a plan.
I completely and totally agree. And, you know, I will also remind these Democrats that Joe Biden followed a very similar policy here. He was not negotiating new free trade agreements. He didn't do any of that. And he put more tariffs on China, 100% tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles, and enforced the USMCA, particularly the workers' rights provisions, in a pretty vigorous way, right? And so he kind of laid the marker for this. So it pains me when I see, like, there's some Democrats, you know, the new Dems, kind of the corporate Dems out there, like, these tariffs are going to be a disaster. We're all going to pay a lot more money, and they're doing this stuff, you know, basically parroting the talking points of the Chamber of Commerce, of you know, of the global businesses and of the investment banks that got us into this mess in the first place. And I'm like, hey, right, you know, it, you know, if you say what you will about Trump, but even a broken clock is right twice a day. Yep. Right, and this may be something that he's right about. And so I like the Dems that are leaning into this. Like, there's a congressman from New York, Tom Suozzi, who signed on to a bill to say, let's get rid of PNTR. Jared Golden from Maine was like, I want to do 10% across the board tariffs, right? And so they're like look, let's make this our own kind of brand here rather than just running in the opposite direction.
Yeah, that knee-jerk reaction of it must be a bad idea. Now, look, don't get me wrong. Just because he's identified it doesn't mean he can't make it worse. But sure. I think on this stuff, as you've pointed out, the people that he's put in into those positions have historically not been bad. And for me, that's not comforting, but a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can't think of another agency. I'm scratching my head as I'm doing this, but I can't think of another agency where, like, the principals, like, of the U.S. Trade Office, you know, where you had Bob Lighthizer and then Katherine Tai and now probably Jamison Greer, who's been nominated, probably are very collegial, are really aligned on almost every issue, right, you know, coming into this. And there's probably no other place in government, Rick, that you will see that. And that does speak to something. And so, yeah, it's really annoying when you just see this, like, we're going to resist for the sake of resisting and just say no to everything. And it's like, okay, put the brakes on that. Consider what is best for, you know, making our country more secure, for bringing factory jobs, and you know, work with them. And I know when Pelosi worked with them on renegotiating NAFTA. They got something done.
Yep.
They got something done.
Yeah. No, and yeah. Labor had some good input, and we got some things moved in a better direction. And look, you know, I've given, you know, people ask me, well, name something that you think Trump's done well. I think, you know, the renegotiation of the MCA was a step in the right direction. Was it perfect? No, but there was no Democrat out there pushing for that.
Yeah, and it was, but it was the congressional, it was Pelosi and the congressional Democrats being willing to work with him on something.
Exactly.
Right. And they're like, you know what? We're willing to come to the table with you on this. And that took courage.
It did.
from both sides, really, to make it happen.
Yeah. Now, the de minimis thing, this is one of those things that I can't even believe it's legal. What they get away with, you know, because I'm going through my own personal nightmare with this, because I purchased something, you know, on a website that, you know, I thought was here in the U.S. Here it comes from China. It is not what I wanted. It is not what they sold me. And I want to return it. And they go, well, you have to send it back to China. And the shipping costs are crazy. And it's got to be perfect or we're not going to it was just, I just threw it away and ate it and said, I got to stop buying stuff online. But it's because there's no gate at the border for what they can send in. And good luck fighting them after they've got your money.
Yeah. We have the largest de minimis loophole in the world of any country. It's $800, which is substantial. And unfortunately, it can be used by anyone. It's not just people bringing stuff back from another country. It's used to purchase goods directly from China. And, you know, our trade deficit theoretically has gone down with China because of the tariffs, but a lot of that has been redirected into the de minimis because you don't have to pay anything. You know, there's no tariffs on it. You can bring it in free or whatever. And so there's this whole, as you know, like Shein and Temu. I mean, Temu is still one of the top five apps along with that DeepSeek, which is also terrifying in a different way. But, you know, one of the top five apps on the App Store, right? People are buying the stuff because they're like, wow, I can't believe I can get this whole thing for like $3 that probably would cost $20 to make in the United States.
Yeah, never mind the child labor that went into it or the slave labor, but I can get it. It's...
Yeah. Never mind the lead and the child labor and all
you'll
that
be
other
fine.
Stuff. The stuff it'll fall apart in two years.
Yeah,
right?
Walk it off. You'll be fine. Last question I've got for you. You know, obviously, TikTok, since you brought up the apps, you buying into this TikTok solution of they're going to give half of the company to the federal government, or I'm not even quite sure how that would work, but are you buying any of that?
Look, the law is very clear about what can and cannot be done, and the algorithm, the company can't be owned by a Chinese entity, right? Very clear. And so I don't know how they would get to this issue of some minority ownership. That had been floated before, and actually TikTok turned it down. So, I mean, maybe they'll think about it this way. But Rick, to me, the most important thing is that the Chinese Communist Party doesn't have access to the data of the users, because that's a very valuable data set that, even though I know Trump dismissed it, what do they want, like, the kids watching the videos for? It's like, obviously, there's more than that on TikTok, number one. And number two, it's like there's a lot of evidence that the app, you know, is tracking keystrokes and all sorts of other online behaviors and is going to have, like, you know, the ability to have a dossier on everybody, right? You don't want to – why would you hand that over to a country that is planning for a war scenario against you? It doesn't make any sense.
And
so, no, I'm not buying it. Right.
And the fact that, you know, this is where my problem, all of what you said is valid and I agree with you, but it's that next level. You know, do I want the Chinese Communist Party to have a direct link to what my children see? Their algorithm pushes things toward them that I think is not good. In their country, a lot of the stuff doesn't get seen by their children. The fact that we're going to allow their propaganda in our children's bedrooms and in their eyes at every moment of the day is extremely troubling to me. And I know this is old school Cold War kind of thinking, but sorry, they wouldn't let us do it. Why are we dumb enough to let them do it?
Yeah. Well, the latest example is just this new AI tool that was developed in China that is now out and available on the app stores as well, called DeepSeek.
Yeah.
And it, apparently, and I've seen this, if you enter like a question about Tiananmen Square, or I hear there's a famous picture of a guy holding grocery bags in front of a tank. What is that about? And you ask the AI that, it will start to give the answer that it will stop and just, you know, talk like Hal from 2001 Space Odyssey. It's like, I can't help with you that with you right now. I'm not capable of doing that. So it's like the winners write the history, yeah. Right? To your point.
Come on.
They should not be able to erase it.
No, look, you know, Trump is the Justice Department is erasing most of what happened on January 6th. It's those people in power who rewrite our history. It's our job to remind them and to remember and to not let it happen again. And I fear that's kind of where we are. But as always, Scott, great information, great stuff. I appreciate the time. I'll look forward to talking to you again next time.
Likewise, Rick. Thanks so much for having me on.
Our good friend Scott Paul. Want to hear your thoughts. You got any of this this Chinese stuff showing up on your door? Have you had issues? I want to hear about it. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
News from the center, WRCE. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Partly cloudy and mild tonight, a low in the mid-20s. For tomorrow, mostly sunny. The heat kicks in with highs into the mid-50s. Maybe a shower early Friday, then turning partly sunny, highs into the mid-40s. It's 28 degrees right now.
The Todd Alba Show.
The argument from my former party has been, it's not the guns, it's mental health. Well, no worries, folks. Governor Evers has got you covered. He introduced a plan to put millions of dollars into mental health, particularly for young kids. And the Republicans in the chamber did not clap. If you can't be it for kids, then what the heck can you be for? Jeepers, criminy.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So our quote of the day from that amazing philosophical political thought leader, Anthony Scaramucci. You may remember him. We now evidently we clock time in Scaramucci's. How little time he spent as what was a communications director there at the White House, press secretary. I don't even remember. He was there so short. Don't even remember what it was. But the Mooch said of Donald Trump, "We're about to break something. Our relationship with the rest of the world that took 80 years to cultivate." And he's not wrong. What we're seeing out of Trump so far, the ultimate in bully tactics. And not surprising, we've pulled out again of the Paris Climate Agreement and signaling to the rest of the world, well, we're not going to be your friend. But understand, he did go to L.A., you know, while all the people's homes are built. Looked like a tough guy. You know, looked like he was fighting for the little guy who lost everything. But probably going to make that scene, because of his bad policy, a lot worse. And here to share some thoughts on what that might look like, I've asked my good friend Mike Williams to come share some thoughts. He's a senior fellow for domestic climate at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website. Mike, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick. It's always a pleasure to be here.
So what do you make of the big pullout? What do you make of the Trump decision to again yank us out of the Paris Climate Accord?
Well, I mean, you keep pulling out, you obviously are not committed. So that is, this is America showing the rest of the world that we just can't put down our roots and stay committed. Joking aside, that's actually what it's showing.
Yeah.
The rest of the world can't trust us now. We on a multilateral stage, especially on something as critical as the climate crisis, we can't be looked to as a leader. Look to as a partner right now, especially right now. But even if we get through this and 4 years from now, we have a better administration that comes back to the table. Hey, we're back. Next time it'll be like, and so what? we're not working with China.
Yeah.
We're working with Brazil. We're working with the EU. We can't trust you. No, and this that's what we're dealing with right now.
Yeah, and this is why I brought up the Scaramucci quote. And I was like, wow, that's pretty insightful. And it's completely accurate.
Yeah. I mean, the guy did his job in like 4 days, right? So, I mean, you know, anybody can pull that off. You know, he's obviously he's a mensch.
He's a go-getter. But, you know, again, you know, the thing that you've pointed out is this kind of, and this is the fear I've had for our country, this kind of banana republic back pendulum swing of extremes. Because, look, you know, during the Biden years, we invested in a lot of green technology. We invested a lot in EV, in battery technology. Does all that stuff just go to the dustbin?
If we go on the trajectory that it seems like Trump wants us to, yeah, maybe. Because the trajectory we were put on by Biden is that all of a sudden we became a big player in the future of auto manufacturing. We have, for a long time, been a huge player in auto manufacturing, right? And we've dealt with shocks from Japan, we've dealt with shocks from Europe, but we still are holding strong. Auto manufacturing in the US employs a lot of people, and we've had a lot of companies come here. We are now facing one of, if not the most existential crisis with auto manufacturing, and that's China, its entrant into the market. And the only way we're going to deal with that is if we have a functioning and thriving electric vehicle manufacturing sector. Biden administration knew that. They put in a significant amount of investment. We became one of the biggest manufacturers of batteries in the world. We have huge facilities in Ohio, in Georgia, in Michigan, in Tennessee, that have billions of dollars of both public and private investment behind it, employing tens of thousands of people. And then Trump comes in on day one, is like, no more, no more, no more. And so, okay, poof. Guess what? This goes this way. A couple years time, everybody's going to be driving BYDs. You know what a BYD is,
yeah.
Rick?
Yeah.
BYD is Chinese-made vehicle. Guess what? They're way cheaper than our cars. Guess what? They're not crappy.
No, not anymore.
I'm not, their technology. I'm not defending how they make it. There's significant problems with that. But we pull away, we get rid of the support for this industry, you're going to see a ton of Chinese cars on the road.
Yeah, but you know, also, that's not just the auto workers. It's not just the people who are working for Ford or GM. It's just not those people. It's all of the feeder jobs that go into this. And I talk about this a lot from 2016 when my family, you know, bought the Trump line that he was going to recreate that golden economy that created, you know, millions of good high wage union manufacturing jobs. Because, yeah, you know, Brook Park Avenue in Cleveland had the Ford and the Chevy plant, but they also had hundreds of small little factories that fed into those right across the street. And those were paying good, substantially good wage jobs, good union jobs with health care and retirement and vacations and sick time and all of the things that, well, American workers pine for from the past that we should be fighting for the future. That's what he sold them. And it didn't happen. And yet here we are again.
He's just about ideology, Rick. He doesn't believe this stuff. And this is just proof. Because if he actually believed that, then he would absolutely be dedicated to, we're going to own the future of clean tech and keep these investments going. I'm going to do it even better than Biden. Biden even do it. He would say things like that if he actually cared about the American worker. He doesn't. It's obvious. He cares about his ideology. He cares that renewables or EVs are somehow not masculine or some garbage like that.
Thank
Sorry,
you.
I almost let one fly. That's what he cares about. And so it has to go that way instead of making sense and actually supporting American workers. Because to your point, my friends at the United Steelworkers often like to point out to me quietly that they have more people in the automobile manufacturing sector than the auto workers because of that supply chain. It's massive. Do you remember back in 2009, when people railed against Barack Obama, President Obama, for bailing out the auto industry, for saving them? By the way, around that time, too, the federal government gave Tesla about $500 million loan to keep them afloat. Elon and his doji like to forget about that. The Obama administration they needed to save the auto industry, not just because of the big three, but because of the millions of jobs it impacts across the country, and not just in the Midwest, in the South, in the Northeast, on the West Coast, across the country. It underpins communities across the country. And so, yeah, if I'm animated, it's because I'm freaked out by it. Got to be honest with you. This pullback from this, along with Chinese investment in EVs, means we're just basically like a prize fighter dropping his hands.
Yeah. And also, you know, as we've been talking about on the program for a while, as AI and robotics and automation and all this stuff continues to come online, you know, there was a report done, you know, several years ago that in 20 years, half of the jobs we currently do will be gone. And as the new jobs come online, they're going to be automated or robotics or AI or all that stuff. And the question then becomes, you know, what are American workers going to do if we're seeding the new technologies, the next generation of good manufacturing and good family sustaining jobs? If we're seeding that to China or anywhere, Mexico or wherever, what does that mean for us and our prosperity? Now, I know Doge Boy, he believes that, you know, we're going to have a universal high income and everyone's going to get everything they need. And, you know, we can be gluttonous and not have to work. And that's what he's selling. I know it's not true because we could do that now, but we won't. So this used car salesman pitch that we're getting is a failure for working people in every way, shape or form. It's a giant lemon.
Giant lemon. Huge lemon. It completely is divorced from reality. It's divorced from any person who's, you know, looked at what it takes to, you know, make yourself and your community better. You have to invest in your community. You have to put dedication. You have to see what the challenges are and take them head on. This is just basically turning around and walking away from the problem and letting the problem just effectively fester. Yeah. And take you over. So yeah, no, it's terrible. On top of that, I don't even want to say that, because the thought that all of a sudden Americans are just going to stop buying EVs and start buying gas cars, that, I mean, this is maybe the addled brain of Trump. EV uptake, in spite of pushback, in spite of bad news, went up, I think, 9% just last year, and it's up like 70% over 2 years, and it's up 160% over 3 years. So it's growing here. It's growing across the world. China added, I think it went up 40% EV purchasing. So this notion that, oh, like, no, the good days are going to be back. We're going to be driving old Cadillacs like 1985 again.
We're getting those gas guzzlers that get, you know, 6 miles to a gallon. That's what we're going back to. No, look, yeah. I've driven an EV, and look, I loved it. Responsive as all can be, a lot simpler to fix. There's so many upsides to this. But again, I do have some problems and some questions about, you know, recycling batteries and doing all that stuff, but those are problems that I think we can address, and we're not going to have to, you know, I don't know, breathe all of the exhaust fumes. Not like I didn't breathe enough during the 70s before we had emissions controls, but there is that.
Hey, we could be like, you know, the Iron Curtain and drive Yugos and things like that, and just like hold on to our own, you know, like we refuse to deal with anything else and just be like the Soviet Union.
Do they still drive Yugos?
I don't know. Okay. I mean, they're not the Soviet Union anymore, but, you know, they're not in great shape either. Yeah. Heck, after this, they might be, you know, have a piece of the EV manufacturing boom because we'll stop making them. And China will be like, well, we need to make them other places. Might as well stick them in Russia.
No, that's interesting. You brought up the Yugo, man. And, you know, if you thought the Yugo was bad, you know, some of the Chinese cars that are coming in, I think it'd be worse. Because if you remember during the time when the Yugos were coming in, it was like a buy one, get one free kind of deal. You would buy one to get one for parts.
But here's the thing, like we could pick out, like, those are terrible cars.
They
like
were
functionally bad, right? The reviews from auto people, that BYDs are not bad.
Yeah.
The VinFast from Vietnam are not bad cars. They're actually quite good. They're basic, a lot of them, but they do exactly what you need to do. They're functional. They could sell for like $15,000 right now. you tack on the 100% tariff, they're going to sell for like 25.
So no, but here's the thing. And this is the question that I have for you then, because, you know, will Americans go for that? I think they will. I think if you allow that to open up, people are struggling. Wages haven't been going up and been stagnant. Corporate profits have been pocketed by the CEOs and in the shareholder class. I think that brand loyalty, that American, you know, mindset of like we buy only American cars, but it's harder and harder to find one that's American made. You know, they're sourced all around the world. It's getting harder. So this idea of loyalty to a brand, I think, is going away. And I think if the Chinese were to be able to get in, I think it would kill everybody.
Correct. That's exactly right. And if the domestic automakers don't have the market and support and investment, yes, that will happen.
Yeah. No, I have a 1997 Ford F-150. It's got roll down windows. It's got manual locks. I wish I could get it in stick shift. You can't do that anymore. I want a basic work truck. You cannot find in this country a basic work truck anywhere. Everything's got leather seats and vibrating cup holders and all kinds of stuff. It's a truck. I want a truck to haul and do work, not something I'm going to go on a date with on Friday night.
Yeah. I mean, that's where they make all their money too. The auto industry, the plussing up of these cars. It's where they make all the money.
I don't want to get into my rants about how crazy things have gotten on that front, but I sound old. I want utilitarian. I want functional. If I want something comfortable, I'll buy that for you know, whatever. I do got to get your thoughts on Trump going to L.A. and that display that we saw of him looking like the tough guy fighting for, you know, just the poor victims of this fire, with the backdrop of what we know, pulling out of the climate agreement and the policies that he's going to pursue going forward. That, I think, is going to make these situations happen more often, more and worse. I want to get your thoughts on that whole charade.
It's a guarantee it's going to make it worse. That, so he liked to make it, said multiple stupid things about the fires. You know, what, you know, if we need to turn the valve on and send the water down. Like there's a big valve somewhere, like, you know, Bugs Bunny, like tied it up somewhere in Central California.
It's like Bush's spigot. Got to turn on a spigot.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I mean, we can talk about water policy and California water policy. We can talk about endangered species protection. We can talk about the usage for agriculture and like how a lot of it's going to almond farming and things like that. Well, sure, we can have that discussion if we're going to be adults about this and try to be smart about it. It's not some dumb valve that's open or closed, first of all. Second, it's not because firefighters are woke now that we can't fight fire. That is absurd. That's just, it's offensive to all like the firefighters exist. Putting their lives on the line, the men and women out there who are fighting this, you know, in very dangerous places. So that's stupid. The only reason for this is because climate change is making our weather crazier. The Santa Ana winds were higher. It was drier because of drought conditions. So yes, pulling out of the Paris agreements, trying to get the oil industry to drill more, even though we're drilling peak right now, we are drilling the most we have. That's Joe Biden's energy economy. In addition to a massive amount of renewables, he actually helped the oil industry in interesting ways ramp up its production. We are the biggest oil and gas producer in the world. And there was an article out today from the New York Times that said the oil industry wanted Trump to win, but they don't necessarily want to drill more. And the only way they drill more is if the cost of oil went up.
Yep.
So they'd make more money. And so you, because I have an EV, sorry, Rick, would pay more at the pump so the oil industry could make more money. So, yeah, he went there to go look tough and be like, oh, I'm going to stick up for the working man. But he's been spouting this nonsense, and he's just going to make it worse.
But here's the
thing. This is going to happen again and again and again. Yeah. And he wants to tie aid to ridiculous things about voter ID and things like that, trying to force political choices on people who did not want that. I mean, they vote for their representatives, and they decide that at a state level. But you're going to tie their aid? And then he's talking about killing FEMA, too? Yeah. I mean,
no, that's who these people are. I mean, they're showing us who they are. And yeah, well, I don't know why you're surprised by that. I expect that. But, you know, what the message, though, to the average person, I think, gets, and I use my mother-in-law as kind of that, you know, that average American. She still believes it's because, you know, Gavin Newsom wasn't out there with a rake, you know, raking the woods, and that the reservoirs are bone dry empty because they fed all the water to Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's just not the case.
You can't tell her that, though. She knows.
I know. It's, I mean, that I don't know how to fix. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, we spent all summer at the Center for American Progress talking about Project 2025 and how awful it's going to be. And we started explaining it to the American people. Yeah. And it included, one of the things recommended was getting rid of FEMA. The other one was like eviscerating water conservation policies, obviously pulling out of the Paris Agreement, all of these things it said in there. And what did we get? We got two things. First, voters were like, that's terrible. We don't want that. That's awful. And so because of that, Trump is like, oh, I disavow it. I'll never do that. I don't want that. Maybe there's some good ideas, but no, I don't want that. And then the second thing we got was that the mainstream media almost sudden said like, oh, Trump disavowed it. He's not going to do Project 25. He said he wasn't going
to
do it.
He wouldn't lie to us again.
He's literally doing every single thing out of Project 2025 that we said he was going to do.
Yeah, well, as Tim Walz said, you don't come up with a playbook if you don't plan on using it.
Yep. The coach knows.
Yeah, simple, simple stuff. But you know what? It's going to get worse. And sadly, the messaging not there because our media just not doing the job. But Mike, I appreciate the thoughts, the input. I know we will be back talking about this again at some point very soon. This administration will be doing some crazy stuff. So I look forward to talking to you again.
Anytime, Rick. Thanks.
Thanks so much. Mike Williams, chief cook and bottle washer there with the domestic climate center there at the Center for American Progress. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Do you think it's going to get worse? Let me put it this way. Do you think it was about, you know, Gavin Newsom not out there with a rake, you know, raking up all the underbrush or the reservoirs being completely bone dry empty because they were putting water into LA so people could drink? You think because there are too many people there? You buying it? I want to hear it. rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Yes, we're making the world hate America again. And this is where, you know, Anthony Scaramucci's not wrong. We're breaking relationships that we have built over decades. This administration is going to break up the rest of the world. And it'll be interesting to see what the realignment is. If Trump's goal is to align with dictators or want to be dictators, boy, we're in trouble. And also, you know, this idea of having presidential temper tantrums, this idea that I'm going to get what I want or hell will pay. For instance, just saw that the Trump administration has instructed organizations around the world that we give aid to stop distributing HIV medications. That's purchased with U.S. dollars. So if we give you aid to help your country and you buy AIDS drugs with it, you buy HIV medications, there will be hell to be paid. Even if the drugs are already purchased and sitting in the local hospitals. Now, understand, this is one of those, just a small part of a bigger assault on foreign aid. And this is one of those things that the base will love. And I keep saying the more federal aid we cut, the more the refugee crisis happens. The more you make other places unbearable to live and the crime to be incredibly high, the more people are going to want to escape. And the more they're going to want to come, well, I would argue, here. And the more they're going to want better for their families, better opportunity, better hope. And here we are. We're making HIV great again. Now, what's interesting in talking with Mike Williams, the fact that he made a point there that I wanted to clarify. And I wanted to amplify, actually, because when he said there are more steelworkers who work in the auto industry than UAW workers, he's not wrong. Now, the glass, the rubber, all of that stuff, that those are done by jobs are done by steelworkers. And understand, in the old days, when we used to make parts here and we used to make all the carpeting and all of the content that went into it. So when I talk about, you know, Brook Park Avenue, where I grew up as a kid, the Ford plant being on one end of the street, the Chevy plant being a couple miles down the block, and every space on the other side of the street, nothing but small machine shops and small factories that fed into those. Every little part, every you know, clip, every, you know, bolt, all of that stuff was manufactured right there. And it was sent across the street, shuttled across the street. That was their just-in-time inventory. And I think about those jobs and that setup and what we've allowed to be given away. My fear of Trump going back on EVs and on battery technology and trying to return us to the 50s and 60s, where a lot of working people think that was the golden age. Early 70s, this idea that one income can support a family, which nobody thinks is possible today. The idea that you work hard, you play by the rules, you get ahead. The fact that the Trump administration even used the word meritocracy is laughable. But they're selling this narrative. And it's imperative to us to, well, look at their record. Look at what they're doing. My fear is we lose the auto industry entirely. Because Mike Williams is right. The Chinese aren't making Yugos. They're not making garbage cars anymore. And what they can produce them for is, well, would be very enticing to a large portion of the population. So if your goal was absolute consumption, if your goal as a political economist was just to get as much stuff into people's hands, we would give up the auto industry, those millions of jobs that feed into that and live off of that. And we would just allow cheap Chinese cars to flood our markets. My hope is we got politicians who are not that stupid. And we've got citizens who want to demand better. And as we talked about with Scott Paul, I think Trump understands that those are important issues for working people in a way that Democrats, I don't think, have. But his solutions haven't really, really done the job. It's one thing to identify a problem. It's another thing to not make it worse and to actually try and go in a direction that's going to make it better. I don't have much faith that Trump is that guy. He hasn't proven that to be his track record throughout his entire life. So this idea that we're going to put him up on a pedestal is quite laughable in this moment. Given the fact that, you know, the country is now in a bit of chaotic situation and the relationships that have been built, the historic norms that have been in place for decades are now all on the table. And some are going to say, good, finally, we need to realign. We need to reprioritize. I would feel much more comfortable if the person doing that actually had a record of supporting working people. I'm not seeing that. And I'm not seeing it out of Trump. I'm not seeing it out of most of his cabinet. It's kind of frightening. Look, do I hope he succeeds? I do, actually. I'm not going to be one of those people who say, I hope he fails. I don't. Because if he fails, that means we all fail. But I've seen this movie. Sadly, doesn't end well for you or me. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Is there something that you see that you go, hey, maybe that's something we can work with the Trump people, maybe to divert him away from some of the horrible stuff? Or are you in the camp of most of the people that contact me of no, resist everything? and then be in the I hope he fails camp. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Curious your thoughts. Want to get the temperature of folks out there. Because as I said earlier, you know, sadly, a lot of people are not sufficiently worried in my mind. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks so much for being here. See you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center, and always on the Civic Media app.
This is a special report from ABC News. I'm Richard Cantu. A regional jetliner and a military Black Hawk helicopter collided midair at Washington, D.C.'s Reagan National Airport.
The American Airlines regional jet was inbound from Wichita, Kansas, and on final approach to Reagan National when it collided with the helicopter over the Potomac. Video shows a brief flash and then smoke. Rescuers were immediately dispatched. Divers were said to be pulling people out of the frigid water. Some 60 people were reported to have been on the regional jet.
ABC Stephen Portnoy in Washington.
The problem with this time of year is obviously the water is quite cold. There is ice on the Potomac most of the way up towards the Key Bridge. And so getting anybody that is still alive out of the water quickly is going to be the real key for the fire department here.
ABC News contributor Steve Ganyard is a former Marine aviator. No numbers currently on casualties or survivors. This is ABC News. Investors were thrown into a tizzy this week with a Chinese company's claim it developed a